Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
During this past week, the soybean crop condition rating did not change. 52% rated good to excellent, 18% poor to very poor. That's for beans.
But corn showed another drop.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says we lost another 1% out of the good to excellent category, added another 2% on to the corn rated poor to very poor.
A little bit of a surprise considering the maturity level on the corn.
USDA reports 54% of the corn crop already fully mature. The average for this week of the year is 44%.
Of course, as those numbers climb, that quickly renders any frost and freeze issues irrelevant.
That's good. As to why, though, corn condition dropped this last week, Rippey says it's anybody's guess.
Maybe folks getting out in the fields and realizing that maybe that Western Corn Belt isn't as bright and rosy as some folks thought.
Gary Crawford, Washington.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Now, if you look at the individual states, we have 6 of the 18 reporting states coming in with more than 1/5 of the corn rated very poor to poor.
Brad Rippey is a meteorologist with USDA, takes a look at current crop conditions, starting with corn.
Led by Missouri at 40%, Kansas at 36%, and then several states in the 20s, including Nebraska, 27%, Minnesota, Texas, both at 24%, and Illinois, 22%, very poor to poor.
That's corn. What about soybean conditions?
Looking at the soybean numbers for condition, 52% good to excellent and 18% very poor to poor. Compared to last year at this time, actually pretty similar. 55% good to excellent was our number on September 17th, 2022. 15% very poor to poor. Now, looking at the individual states for soybeans, we've got 5 of them coming in with more than 1/5 of the crop rated very poor to poor, led by Kansas, a very high number at 47%. And then we've had the issues in the South with soybeans, 34% very poor to poor, and Louisiana, other states coming in the 20s, Nebraska at 28%, Missouri 23%, Illinois 21%.
We'll step back and look at corn. Harvest progress.
In terms of the corn harvest, almost to the 1/10 mark by September 17th, the national number is 9% harvested. That is ahead of the 5-year average of 7% and also ahead of last year's 7%. Among Midwestern states leading the way in harvest progress is Missouri, 19% harvested, 5-year average there, 14%. And of course, the big harvest numbers are coming in out of the South, where it's typical to have the corn cut pretty early in the year. And combine that with the drought and the heat this year, we've got Texas, 68% of the corn harvested. Number 2 among the 18 major states is North Carolina, 65% harvested.
Earlier mentioning soybean crop ratings, what about crop progress?
We have 54% of the U.S. soybeans dropping leaves by September 17th, significantly ahead of the 5-year average of 43% and last year's 39%. We have our first look at U.S. soybeans harvested. The date, September 17th, the number is 5%. That is slightly ahead of the 5-year average of 4% and last year's 3%. Not surprisingly, almost all of the significant harvest progress is across the Deep South. Drought-stricken and heat-stricken Louisiana leading the nation, 66% of the soybeans harvested there. 5-year average is 48%. Not much different in Mississippi, 42% harvested, 5-year average, 26%.
Then there's the latest on both harvesting and conditions of peanuts.
We have our look at peanuts here showing the harvest progress moving along to 4% by September 17th. That is 1 point behind the 5-year average. Peanut condition has trailed off a bit here late in the season, and we're looking at a crop that is now rated 53% good to excellent. That's actually up a point from last week. 12% very poor to poor. That's actually down 2 points from last week. So a slight improvement, but that follows many weeks of declining conditions. Last year at this time, we were looking much better at 67% good to excellent and just 6% very poor to poor. One of the biggest impacts has been the drought in the Southern Great Plains, Texas, leading the nation with 37% of the peanut crop rated very poor to poor.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I'm visiting with Jeff Cooper with the Renewable Fuels Association. We're at the Farm Progress Show in Decatur, Illinois. And Jeff, I'd like you to talk a little bit about, it's a recent announcement, your efforts at RFA to seek fair treatment for ethanol as a SAF feedstock. What does that mean, and what is the need for fair treatment?
Well, about a year ago, Chuck, you might recall that the president signed into law the Inflation Reduction Act. And in that bill, Congress created a new tax credit for sustainable aviation fuel. And sustainable aviation fuel, or SAF as we call it, is just like it sounds. It's aviation fuel that reduces greenhouse gas emissions by 50% or more compared to conventional petroleum-based aviation fuel. And really the whole idea is the aviation sector is a huge source of greenhouse gas emissions. It's not likely to be a sector that is easily electrified. And so the airlines and other stakeholders are looking at how can we use liquid fuels that are lower carbon to reduce emissions from aviation. And so that was really the thought behind this tax credit that was in the bill that passed last year. Well, now, a year later, we are waiting for the guidance and really the final rules from the IRS on how this tax credit is going to be administered, what fuels are eligible, and we're really concerned by some of the things we're hearing. We are hearing that some of our friends in the environmental community are advocating for a methodology to be used that would effectively disqualify corn ethanol from eligibility for that tax credit if it's used to make sustainable aviation fuel. And it's all based on, again, faulty carbon modeling and outdated information and old science. They're relying on a bunch of modeling and a methodology from Europe that's using data that's more than 10 years old. And so really our efforts have been focused on, hey, let's use the best available science. Let's use the most current and scientifically robust modeling tools. And specifically, we're talking about the Department of Energy's GREET model to serve as the basis for evaluating different fuels when it comes to their eligibility for the SAF tax credit. So that's really the push that we have underway. Like I said, we're anxiously awaiting that guidance from IRS. We're expecting in the next month or two we'll see something from IRS and the Department of Treasury that provides more detail on how they plan to move forward. So that's really the push that we have going right now. We've got some advertising going on. We've been doing lots of meetings and phone calls and grassroots efforts trying to get the administration to use the latest science and the best available information when it comes to assessing the carbon footprint of corn ethanol-based aviation fuel. So this tax credit is supposed to be already available to industry, and certainly they want January 1st of 2024 to have this tax credit available. That's going to be really hard to get done if we're still, sitting here at the end of August waiting on basic guidance around how this is all going to work. So it is hurry up and wait, but we have been very active behind the scenes sharing, the latest data and information about corn ethanol's carbon footprint with all of the folks in the administration that are dealing with this. Again, you got to remember, these are tax credits. So this is IRS. This is the Treasury Department. These are folks who don't know, this is all new to them. Life cycle analysis and biofuels, these are not things that they are expert in. So it's been a steep learning curve for that agency. They've been working closely with the Department of Energy, USDA, and others to get themselves up to speed on how exactly to manage this.
So here with Jeff Cooper from Farm Progress Show, I'm Chuck Zimmerman.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
First of all, as it relates to the Trade Representative's Office, I think the USDA has a responsibility of making sure that there's a close communication between the U.S. Trade Representative's Office and USDA.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack on the importance of trade for U.S. Ag.
I think we need to make sure that we work collaboratively with them to implement existing trade agreements. Specifically, I'm talking about the USMCA. There are issues relating to Canada and Mexico with reference to implementation. I would hope to be able to work closely with USTR on those issues. I think we want to provide advice and counsel and direction and efforts to try to look at additional free trade agreements that could potentially be negotiated during the course of the Biden-Harris administration. I think it's fair to say that we have work to do in terms of making sure that we have a competitive opportunity. Many of our competitors are engaged in free trade agreements that provide a competitive edge. In many markets, we need to reduce that competitive edge. And I think that the Undersecretary's office is an incredibly important one to do three things. One, to have a presence in those export markets to make sure that U.S. agriculture is front and center in the minds of folks who are purchasing and consuming in those markets. Two, I think that office needs to work to create more partnerships in those foreign market opportunities. I know that there are universities, there are other ways in which we can create the kinds of relationships between our agriculture and our food companies and the consumers in these markets. And finally, we need to be part of an effort to continue promotion of U.S. agricultural products. I think if you have more presence, more partnerships, and more promotions, you'll have more trade.
But in over 2.5 years, no new free trade agreements and not really any movement on that front.
It indeed starts with markets. Historically, we've obviously looked at export market opportunities. Anywhere from 20 to 30% of what's produced in this country gets exported. So clearly a stable, secure trade policy that doesn't create havoc in the market, that doesn't put us at a competitive disadvantage would be helpful in terms of our ability to sell product overseas. Expanding market opportunities in new market. I think Southeast Asia is an opportunity. I think eventually over time, we're going to see potential opportunities in Africa. One half of the world's increased population is liable to come in the next 15 years in that single continent. So we want to obviously be engaged in trade opportunities there as they evolve. Certainly our competitors are doing that. But it's more than just export markets. It's growing markets here domestically. By investing in a robust local and regional food system that creates market opportunities for small and mid-sized producers so they can negotiate their own price. We began that process in the Obama administration, but I think there's much, much more work that could be done in that space. It's about creating new markets, markets that have never been developed before. Carbon sequestration and storage, if done the right way. The opportunity for methane capture and reuse, if done the right way. The development of bio-based manufacturing that creates new market opportunities for agricultural waste, if done in the right way, can all create a more stable farm income and economy, and can also help to create and support the jobs that many farm families need as well in rural places. It's also about making sure that we have a safety net that operates. I mean, our farmers are definitely more interested in markets than they are aid, but there are times and circumstances that it requires significant investment by the government. We need to be prepared to do that, and we need policies and programs that allow and enable that. And we need, obviously, a strong crop insurance program that provides protection in the event that Mother Nature simply won't cooperate. So it's all of that and probably much, much more.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack, it's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
One of the things that the canal authority is doing now is to figure out how they can reuse the fresh water after it is used to lower or raise the ship.
Dr. Sundaresh Haragu is Regents Professor and Associate Dean, College of Engineering, Architecture and Technology at Oklahoma State University, talking about the issue of a drought in Central America and how it's affecting the Panama Canal.
They are figuring out ways to reuse it. But, you know, in the intermediate to long term, they're also looking at building a dam and diverting water from another river down into the canal. But that would require laying water pipes that run, you know, 10, 15, 20 kilometers. All of this takes time. But the other, of course, you know, you asked about the cost, right? The costs have gone up somewhere between 30% and 45%, and shippers, like I said, are having to figure out which ones are they not going to include in their shipment because of the reduced weight requirements. So, you know, soybean transportation throughout has dropped by 50%. So, you know, just having a number of impacts. But in terms of other alternatives, I guess U.S. intermodal is one option. So I guess you could unload on the West Coast, you know, for goods that are going from the Pacific to the Atlantic. You could unload them on the West Coast and then you know, transfer them onto flatbed rail cars and ship them through. But then we always have to remember the cost, but also the capacity. If you put containers on a freight rail, you can only do 240 containers, whereas a cargo ship carries up to 15,000. So you probably need many more trains to transport the number of containers that you have in a ship. But the other solutions would be maybe looking at local sourcing, diversifying the sources of products that you get, whether it's agricultural or manufacturing, some closer to the source of consumption. If you were able to procure your goods, maybe that relieves some of the pressure on the canal until we tide this over and Mother Nature blesses Panama with more rain. These are some of the steps that we would have to take. Of course, the other thing I'll mention that's working against us is that the peak season for agricultural products transportation is the fourth quarter. And of course, that's also the holiday season. So there's going to be increased demand just from the natural cycle. And, we're having to deal with increased demand but reduced capacity.
Add those issues with low levels on the Mississippi River, and it's a recipe for disaster.
You mentioned about, the Mississippi water levels. In the Rhine River, there is the same kind of situation. So we may have to, in some cases, especially for goods that are coming from, India and surrounding countries, may have to use the Suez Canal. That's entirely ocean, so they may, I'm talking about the goods that are going to the East Coast. They'll have to make use of that, which is, again, also pretty congested. It's more expensive. Other than, short of going around Cape Horn, adding 8,000 miles of additional, that takes a couple of weeks to travel, adding more time to the consignment to arrive in the East Coast. There are not that many options, frankly.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
My name is Owen Wagner. I'm a senior analyst, grains and oil seeds, within the Food and Agricultural Research Team. I'm based in Raleigh, North Carolina. I've been with Rabobank about a year now. The first project that I worked on was for sustainable aviation fuel, so that would fit very nicely in that type of model of these broad sectoral changes that are going to impact agriculture for better or for worse.
We've been talking a lot lately about a couple of cover crop products,
yes.
One camelina, yep. Another carinata, that will potentially have an extra revenue stream for farmers by harvesting it and crushing it for oil. Is that something you think will be included in the reports at some point?
Yeah, I think there's potential there. I would maybe caution or wouldn't be so bold to say that we're going to see a massive expansion of these newer crops in places like Decatur, Illinois, where corn and soybean rotation is sacred. But there's a lot of U.S. agriculture that does not look like the Midwest. These peripheral production areas, as I mentioned, I'm based in North Carolina. We're seeing more and more winter canola grown in North Carolina. Wow, winter canola has been well established in Oklahoma for years. Going back to camelina that you introduced, that's a good one because camelina was the fuel or the oil seed of choice when the Air Force began its SAF program back in 2011, and that endured for 5 or 6 years with success. I think the challenge with some of these programs is that farmers are going to want some level of guarantee. I think there's been too many of programs over the years for either niche crops or crops with some sort of novel trait. Where there was the moon and the stars were promised and premiums were promised, but hey, say there was a yield drag there that was just too tough to overcome, or the commercial partner may have gone defunct before the farmer had a chance to deliver that crop. So I think there's a lot of caution, rightly so, on the part of farmers when they are adopting some of these newer crops.
Well, this one, point of it is to use it as a cover crop in between, say, even soybean on soybean, for that matter,
right.
So that you're accomplishing two things. One is on the carbon side, you're getting a benefit of that,
sure.
And then hopefully, like you said,
yeah.
They have a market to develop a product that could be a SAF. product, basically.
Yeah, I mean, so camelina being a good example of that. It's you know, unlike soybeans that are an oil seed in quotation marks, I mean, camelina is very much more tilted toward the oil side of the profile. And we know from the biofuel policies that are in place, like it, you know, it is the oil that's in demand right now. But you've touched on an important point, and that's the kind of the sustainability aspect of this, which is being monetized more and more, which is important. You know, for a long time, there was discussions underway without the proper incentives, you know, to get farmers to make some of these changes. We've seen pilot programs over the years. RMA had those $5 credits that could be applied toward crop insurance premiums a couple years ago. $5 was not really enough to get people excited. Now we've got this Farmers for Soil Health initiative that's $50 over 3 years. So, you know, these premiums are going in the right direction. So that's a direct benefit to the grower. But we also know that more and more of incentives, like beginning with biofuels, for example, that those incentives are also going to be tied directly to the CI, the carbon intensity score of the feedstock that's being produced. And in theory, that incentive, if it begins with the farmer, should trickle back to the farmer in the form of the price that he or she receives for that crop. You know, we would anticipate that, you know, going into the farm bill negotiations, that more and more farm supports are going to follow that model of being tied in some form or fashion to, you know, the sort of environmental practices that are adopted on the farm.
I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
When I hear folks talk about infrastructure, invariably there is a discussion about roads and bridges and locks and dams and ports and airports, all of which are incredibly important, and we absolutely require significant investment in improving the infrastructure of this country so we remain competitive in a global market and that we can provide safe and secure access for the people of this country.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
But I wonder why we don't also include the forests in that conversation, because to me, they represent a major infrastructure for the country. You mentioned carbon sequestration. The reality is clean air directly connected to forests. Obviously, as we deal with trying to make our kids as healthy as they can, the outdoor recreational opportunities, the economy, the impact of forest in terms of outdoor recreation, hunting, fishing, biking, hiking, et cetera, all very, very significant job growth connected to it. So I would hope that as the Congress deals with infrastructure issues and decides to commit significant resources to rebuilding the infrastructure of this country, that they would include forests in that conversation. Because if they do, we can do a better job of maintaining the forests. In the meantime, I think it's up to the United States Department of Agriculture to use the fire budget fix that you all did enact more effectively and more efficiently, and utilizing that resource to do a better job to make sure that we're not diverting money away from the important job of maintaining and managing our forests. And I'm encouraged by the president's call for a conservation corps. We can put people to work. We can create new opportunities for folks as we do a better job of maintaining and repairing our forests.
Another area Vilsack has been focused on is how to capitalize and grow direct from farmer programs.
But you continue to look for ways in which you can create market opportunities for those small and mid-sized operations. You basically expand significantly the farm-to-school, farm-to-university, farm-to-college, farm-to-prison, farm-to-whatever institutional purchaser may be buying food in the locality, creating ways in which that institutional purchaser of food understands what's being grown and raised. You finance food hubs so that small producers can aggregate the amount of food that they're producing with other similar-sized farm operations so that you have uniformity in processing and packaging and marketing. You obviously continue to expand commitment to farmers markets. You look for ways in which you create risk management tools for those small and mid-sized producers so there's more profit opportunity. You create a transition assistance so people who are interested in going into organic can do it more easily. I mean, Senator, there are a multitude of ways to promote local and regional food systems the Department of Agriculture can utilize existing resources to promote and to provide expansion for. And frankly, it's in everyone's best interest to have this. You also have to expand processing facilities. You have to give people the opportunity to not necessarily to rely on a handful of large processing facilities. You need to create more of that. You started that process with the most recent COVID bill with a small program for processing. It's got to be much, much bigger than that, in my view. You also have a dairy donation program, which I think is an incredibly good idea because there's a disincentive now. You have to spend money to process in order to be able to get it to food banks. You have to make sure that food banks have the infrastructure to collect, store, and refrigerate perishable items if you want more of that to go into the food assistance network if we have a disruption in food service. So there's an entire supply chain program here that needs to be put in place, and USDA can impact and affect every single aspect of that supply chain.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
For the U.S. cotton crop,
like so many other crops this year, kind of a disappointing finish to the season, especially across the southern Great Plains.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says the condition rating for cotton took another dip this past week.
Not a significant dip. We're actually the same in the good to excellent category at 29%, but we did see a rise in the very poor to poor rating to 43%, up from 41% last week, and that places this year's crop pretty squarely within the realm of where we saw last year, which was not a good year for cotton.
And he says that statement's definitely true, probably an understatement for this year in some of the major cotton growing areas.
We continue to see those very poor conditions, the abysmal conditions in Texas and Oklahoma. Oklahoma leads 70%, very poor to poor, closely followed by Texas at 65.
And the heat and drought taking a toll in Louisiana, 25% of that state's cotton rated poor to very poor. Gary Crawford, Washington.